and welcome to the Albion Roar with me, AD Packham, and him, Alan Wares, here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course, on our podcast. We are in your ears with thanks to oldfootballshirts.com. Well, our participation in the League Cup is over for another year after the Cherries picked us off for the second time in a week at Dean Court. So, it's a return to league action for us as Newcastle visit the Amex tomorrow and will no doubt remind us of who won the championship last season. However, Newcastle have allowed us to make the loan signing of goalkeeper Tim Krul permanent. Also this week, there's been further conjecture in regards to the away points scheme after there were 500 no-shows at Bournemouth on Tuesday. I suspect they're all at home watching Bake Off. Joining me today to discuss this and more is Albion Chief Executive Paul Barber. Welcome back to the show, Paul. How are you?
Thank you. Very well, thank you.
How are you settling into life back at the top table?
Well, it's great to be there. I mean, obviously, it's a very, very difficult league. It's changed a fair bit since I was last there with Spurs back at the beginning of the decade, and things have moved on both commercially and I think in terms of the quality of football on the field. But it's great to be there. And I think, you know, so far we've made a decent start. We're certainly not in any way struggling to compete. And obviously, it'll be great to put some more points on the board this weekend if we can.
I was just about to say, now we're in the Premier League. Previously, when you were on here, you were on the board of directors, I think it was, of the English Football League, or the EFL, or whatever it's called these days. I assume that you've had to resign that place since we got promotion.
I lost three jobs in one day, actually. I came off the EFL board, I came off the FA Council, and I came off the Professional Game Board as well. So,
Why'd you come off the FA Council?
Well, because that was I was there as a representative of the EFL, and I was a representative of the Professional Game Board, which is a joint board of Premier League and Football League representatives as a representative of the EFL as well. So when you come out of the Football League, you lose those representations. So
three jobs
in one day on the 17th of April. All gone.
Oh dear! So did you get a lot more?
Well worth it.
Fair, yeah, absolutely. That and the drunken mess afterwards. Did you have you picked up any new gigs since we got to the Premier League? Have you joined any boards of the national game, sort of at the top table? Then,
I'm an ambassador for the England team. So what the FA call an international ambassador. So I get the opportunity once in a while to travel with one of the England teams, men's or women's or boys. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we'll probably attend one of those games in the Czech Republic for the under-19s next month, which is a great honour to represent the FA at an international fixture. So just that one at the moment, and obviously Premier League shareholders meetings with the chairman. They're pretty important meetings to go to, and we've got our next one of those early next month as well.
So with that in mind, then obviously we've already had a women's international at the Amex. Are we likely to get another one or another under 21 game?
Very much so. Yeah, we're considered by the FA to be an excellent venue for hosting international games for both men and women and for the boys, and obviously we get great support from not only our fan base, but right the way across the southern part of the country when we stage those games. So we're very much looking forward to hosting another one. And if we can get one where the fixture works for us as well as the FA, then we certainly intend to do so.
OK, well, we'll move on. We've got a lot to get through. So we'll start with the transfer window. Now, a lot's been made about just how tough the market was this window. I mean, how tough was it, in fact?
It was tough. I mean, you know, we anticipated the market being tough. We knew that prices were going to be high. We knew that the demands of players and agents were going to be high. We knew that it was going to be highly competitive. And we went into the transfer window with some very, very specific targets, particularly up front, where, again, you know, we were looking for a particular type of forward, one that was different to the ones we had. We knew from our work over the year or so leading up to the summer transfer window that there was going to be relatively few of the type of players we wanted available. So it was always going to be difficult in that regard. And so it proved. And, you know, unfortunately, we ended up missing out on the one player or the one position that we particularly wanted. But obviously, we did sign 11 or 12 other players. And you know, most of them have actually made some kind of appearance in the first team, either on the field or on the bench. And I think they've all made a good impression in their various ways so far. So you know, as far as we were concerned, our transfer window was a positive one. It wasn't ultimately as successful as we would have liked it to have been. But there were a number of reasons for that.
But the first player that we did get in was Pascal Gross, and he came in very, very early. How difficult is it to actually get the players in early?
Well, you know, to be honest, it varies. I mean, you know, if you're looking at a particular type of player who perhaps is coming towards the end of his contract, or the club that he is with has made it known that they are going to release him, then by definition, that player wants to see what all of his options are. So, you know, in those situations, you might find yourself having to wait for no other reason than the player and the agent wants to consider all of their options. And they will know the type of player that they are, obviously. They'll also know the sort of clubs that are in the market looking for the type of player they are. They'll also know the other types of player that those clubs will be looking at. And they'll be considering their options all the time. And I think sometimes fans do miss this particular point, that this isn't just a case of buying a player that is sitting there waiting for us to come along. Very often we're trying to buy a player that's sitting there looking at who else might come along. And therefore, their options are perhaps much wider than some people might realise. And therefore, they're in no quick hurry to do the deal. Likewise, in a situation where a club has got a player that they don't particularly want to let go, they're absolutely not in a position to want to let that deal go as quickly as possible. They're going to want to string it out throughout the transfer window, create and build the biggest possible market they can, invite various different bids into the process. And, you know, very often are playing with the media to try and generate a bigger market than already exists. So these are very complex transfer processes and very complex markets. It's not as simple as some people think just to buy a footballer these days. There are many, many different forces at work, some of them not all positive. So, you know, we have to work with what we've got, and all clubs are in the same position. We're not making
in this instance.
It is what it is.
Sure, in this instance, it sounds like that. You know, because it was early. Pascal Gross was actually sort of more minded. Look, I'm not going to muck about. I fancy this, and I'm on my way. I mean, was it as simple as that in this instance?
In those situations, sometimes there is a meeting of the minds very early. You know, a particular player likes the look of the style of football that a club is playing. He likes the idea of moving to a newly promoted Premier League club. He likes the idea of moving to the south coast of England. There's an opportunity for the two clubs to agree a deal quite early, and that enables perhaps the selling club to go into the market with funds guaranteed. So therefore, again, that sometimes the terms of the deal might be attractive at that point to the selling club. And when all things come together like that, it's a fantastic situation. And obviously, your ideal scenario is that you do as many deals as possible like that. But you need a lot of things to come together at the same time for that to happen. And, you know, there's a lot of nonsense talked about, you know, deals have got to be done early to be the most effective. Well, that is just nonsense. Similarly, you know, for deals that get done at the end of the window are just panic buys, equally nonsense. And sometimes it takes the time it takes. Sometimes it can be done quickly. Sometimes you have to be patient. Sometimes you miss out because you're being patient and you're looking at perhaps what your other options might be if that deal doesn't come off. And while you're waiting and while you're patient, one or two of your other options slip through your fingers. So you've always got to make value judgments as to whether it's worth hanging on or whether it's worth moving on and moving on to a different target. These are tricky, no right answer type questions that we have to pose to ourselves all the way through the window.
Sure. Do you feel that, I think that, well, probably not just the Albion, but probably most buying clubs certainly have been hamstrung a wee bit by the ridiculous sums of money off that Neymar's transfer to Paris was all about. You know, the obscene amounts there, people thinking, right, well, let's raise everything here.
Of course, and that's exactly what happened. And, you know, when I said sort of midway through the transfer window, I think it was by the time we'd signed Gross, we'd signed Ryan, we'd brought in Suttner. I think we'd also brought in Izzy at that point. So, you know, we were somewhere around the mid to the end point of July. We'd already signed four players. We brought in a couple of the youngsters just after that as well. And the prices were climbing and climbing even at that point. And there was one particular player we were interested in at the start of the window, who I suspect, if he had still been available at the end of the window, would probably have doubled in price, without exaggeration.
Just for the sake of the way that the market was boiling?
Yes, because if you, I mean, if I can, I'll probably use this analogy again in this conversation, but if you look at the housing market, you know, if a house sells for an incredible price in a particular area at a point in time, it automatically pulls up with it the prices of other houses in that area, perhaps as desirable, maybe slightly less desirable, all the way through the chain. And that's just a natural consequence of a market and people suddenly reacting to a new price point being set. And likewise with strikers, you know, when strikers are in scarce supply, price is going to be high. If you're looking for a particular type of striker, you're then looking at a segment of what is already a scarce market. By definition, the price is going to be high. Mm. And then if you miss one or two opportunities out of that tiny segment that you're looking at, because others are also looking at that segment, then obviously people then know when you come knocking for their player who happens to fit the same bill that the price is going to be higher again. But what you can't do, a bit like when you're looking for a three-bedroom house because you've got two kids and a dog and everything else, you can't then go and buy a one-bedroom flat just because the one-bedroom flat's available. Mm. It's still somewhere to live, but it's not necessarily going to fit your particular needs. And likewise for us, yeah, sure. There's no point in going out and buying another striker of the type that we've already got, because that just doesn't work.
I mean, buying a player is very, again, like you mentioned the housing market there, it is like buying a house in regards to the chain as well. I mean, if you could have a deal fall through further down the train, which will collapse the rest of the deals.
Well, you know, again, without getting into the detail of names, because we don't talk about players that we missed out on, any players that we signed, but you know, we missed out on a striker towards the end of the window that we have been waiting for since the start of the window. And unfortunately, we missed out on that player through no fault of our own. Terms agreed, player medical passed, purely and simply because one other club actually failed in what they thought was a dead cert signing of their own. Hmm. When that happens, there is very little to nothing you can do. And it doesn't matter how much money you throw at it. It doesn't matter how much you beg and plead. And cajole and persuade. Mm. Unfortunately, that club in that situation is simply not going to release their player. Mm. And then you have to move quickly to your other targets. And when we talk about having clusters, this is the reason, because you can't afford to go from a player that's very high on your list to a player that's a long way different to that, both in type and quality. You've got to have these sort of groups of players that are of a similar type that you can move on to. But of course, you know, at that point, when it's late in the window, it's then very difficult to get the deal done, because the club that might have been willing to sell 3 or 4 weeks earlier suddenly finds themselves with days or perhaps even hours to replace the player that they might be prepared to release, and they don't want to take that risk.
But one player that we very nearly did get over the line and we do have to talk about is, of course, Rafael Dornena. How frustrating was that?
Well, again, very frustrating, because a player that we tracked for a long time, fantastic scouting reports. We'd actually got to see him on many occasions live, as well as our normal video scouting. All of our usual due diligence checks were very positive, very favourable. You know, we got the player, you know, through the door. And unfortunately, our medical staff uncovered, you know, a condition which, you know, which is not right to talk about publicly, but a condition that would prevented us from signing him. And in those situations, it's heartbreaking for the player. It's devastating for us, because a huge amount of work and cost has gone into the scouting of that player. And of course, it does make for a setback. You suddenly are then looking again at the market, which you didn't think you'd have to enter again at that point. Yeah. So very, very frustrating all around.
What did you make of the comments attributed to the board of directors in Zurich about the Albion, their take on the Albion's conduct in all this? I mean, they seemed sort of fairly angry at the Albion. I mean, was there any sort of validity in their point, or they caught basic with their pants down?
No validity whatsoever. You know, we are in a process where we're about to spend millions and millions of pounds on a player. Part of that process is to conduct the medical. The player failed the medical. We have no option at that point but to confirm that the player's failed the medical. Why did we even have to speak about the player being in for a medical? Well, someone from the Zurich end leaked the fact that the player was at Brighton for a medical. So in those situations, we've got a choice. We can either play dumb and look dumb with the media and say nothing, or we can say, yes, the player's here for a medical. And of course, the downside of doing that which is why 99.9% of the time we say nothing until a player's medical and the contract is completed successfully, is that you've then got to confirm the player has either failed his medical or, of course, passed his medical. In this situation, unfortunately, for the second time this summer, we had to confirm that he'd failed a medical. We don't confirm the details of why he failed. We don't get into any of the patient confidentiality that governs these things, but we do have to say he failed a medical. And at that point, frankly, there's nothing more we can do and there's nothing more we can say, and we haven't said anything. We're not going to respond to comments from any football club. We've simply returned their player because he failed a medical. What's then happened since then is, as I understand it, he's had a procedure.
He's had a pacemaker fitted, that's right, yeah.
Delighted that will hopefully keep him safe. But our medical staff found the problem that led to the procedure. You can draw your own conclusion as to who's right and who's wrong in that situation.
Okay, I mean, obviously that was very, very frustrating, and like we said, the comments coming out of Zurich were not particularly helpful in that. But the frustration of not landing that new striker has had a knock-on effect. Now, we've obviously got the academy. We've seen already in the League Cup that someone like Desi Hutchinson made his debut, and
James Tilley's been doing
James
very well.
James Tilley's played, and Jason Malumbi's coming into the fore. Now, there's obviously this. We've got strikers in the academy as well. Surely it must be time to look to those if we haven't got anyone else available.
Well, that's obviously one for Chris, but we've also got to keep in mind that our academy is just entering its fourth year. You know, some clubs have been running their academies for four times that amount of time in the Premier League and still haven't managed to bring strikers through. So we're in very early days of our academy. We're in our fourth full year. Prior to that, we were operating out of centres of excellence across Sussex. So the boys that are now coming up to 17 or 18 have only really been with us as an academy since they were 14. And that's a very, very short amount of time to develop and bring on a Championship striker, let alone a Premier League striker. So we've got to be patient. We've got to bring on the players we've got as best we can. James is doing well. We've got other young players behind him doing well. Obviously, it was great to see Desi and Jason in the first team at Bournemouth on Tuesday night. And I thought they did really well. And congratulations to them for their performance. But we've got to be patient. And, you know, there are many, many, many good players coming through the academy. Some of these boys at sort of 12 and 13, we've literally had since they were 7 and 8, because we're now in that stage of the academy where they're beginning to mature. And in 2 or 3, 4 years' time, hopefully we'll be in a position where we'll be able to bring some of those through. But it's a complex process, and it's not a quick fix process. But certainly we're excited about the talent we've got coming through.
Sure. The acquisition of Tim Krul, I think, kind of left people scratching their heads a little bit, because I think when it came to the last day of the season, last day of the transfer window, we're limited with the number of Premier League players that we can have on loan. And it's just two. And when it got to it, then it meant that we got Tim Krul on loan, which meant that any new acquisitions in the last hours of the transfer window would have had to have been a purchase. Could you comment on sort of were we hamstrung by actually the acquisition of Tim Krul, especially now that he is with us permanently, has hindered getting that striker in at the last few hours of the transfer window being open?
No, not at all. We didn't look at any lone strikers in the last few hours of the transfer window, because we knew then what we wanted, and if we could get them, they would be permanent deals. They wouldn't be loan deals. So again, I know there was a lot of speculation around Janssen becoming a loan deal. Mm-hmm. Janssen was never available to us as a loan deal. So from that point of view, there was never a prospect of that. We would have been quite happy to have taken a loan option if one was available to us, but there wasn't one available to us. So it made absolute sense to us to close out the deal on the best possible goalkeeper that we could sign. And at that time, Tim was only available to us on a loan deal, not a permanent deal.
So how come then we've managed to make that permanent now then?
Outside the transfer window.
Because he's in the final year of his contract. So whether he's on a season-long loan or whether we take over his contract for the final year, which is effectively what we've done, it doesn't make any difference to the rules in that situation. But what it does do for us is it gives us more flexibility in January to sign an additional loan player from the Premier League if we want to. So it made absolute sense. the opportunity presented itself to convert that loan to permanent. It makes no difference financially. It just simply gives us the option in January that we didn't have if we'd left him on a loan agreement.
Okay, well, we'll leave the transfer window there, and we'll move on to another subject, which is it's been the hot topic of the week.
There's been several, actually, mate.
Yeah, well, actually,
are we talking Uber here? Are we or something?
Have you ever used Uber?
No.
Twice in London, but I'm a bit of a black cab man myself. I like the black cabs in London. It's what I grew up with. So.
Well, quite. I mean, you might as well take your own skateboard if you rather than take Uber, mate, really. So anyway, sorry, go on. AD, back on script. Yes, there is a script.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. Okay, well, you know where this is going. We had a 1,200 sellout on Tuesday night up at Dean Court. How many actually turned up, Paul?
We had 596 no-shows. And, you know, what I can tell you is 330 of those were from the top tier of our loyalty point holders. And 266 of those were from the lower or mid to lower tiers. So there was no discernible difference between those who didn't show up from being those at the top of the tree, if you like, in terms of loyalty points. From those in the mid to lower tiers. I mean, unfortunately, some people abuse the system. I mean, that's the reality.
So what have you inferred from this?
Well, I think there's a couple of things, really. First of all, you know, we fought quite hard and we've brought Bournemouth Corporation to get the ticket prices for that game to be as low as they possibly could for a couple of reasons. One, football's expensive enough as it is, so where we can keep prices as low as possible, we will. And secondly, obviously, it was the second time we're going to be there in a few days. And we wanted to keep the prices low to help fans, to create an atmosphere for the game, which might have otherwise been a little flatter with a lower crowd and a higher ticket price. And yet, having done that, some people decided that they would sort of harvest the loyalty points rather than turn up and support the team. Mm. We can't force people to go to football matches when they've bought a ticket, clearly. And there will be some people amongst the 596 that didn't turn up that will have had a personal issue, work issue or illness or whatever. We absolutely know that. But what we also know is that over 95% of people turned up at Leicester, over 95% of people turned up at Watford, over 98% of people turned up at Bournemouth 4 days earlier, and even for the Barnet Cup game, 80% of people that bought tickets turned up. So there was absolutely
20%
no doubt.
No-shows for the Barnet game?
Yes.
Wow.
Exactly. Again, complete myth that 50% of people didn't turn up for that game, a complete myth.
I was surprised it was as high as 20%, is my point.
Right, there you go. So there were still some people that
and that's for a home game.
Points for that game. But then again, you know, to be honest, Al, we've had up to 20% of no-shows for league games. So
right,
from that point of view,
yeah.
Not this season, in the past. So from that point of view, that those numbers would show that, you know, at Leicester and at Watford and at Bournemouth in the league, there was no abuse of the loyalty scheme. Mm. Those no-show rates are entirely in line with Premier League averages, which are actually between 5 and 12% typically. Mm-hmm. So from that point of view, it was really disappointing. And I think the most disappointing aspect of it was clearly an abuse of the scheme. And you know, that's disappointing. But it prevented some people that might have wanted to go to the game from going. And perhaps more importantly of all, it prevented there being even more vocal support for the team than we already had. And the people there did a great job, and thanks to them for that. But it was just disappointing. So as a result of that, we're going to have to go back to the drawing board, look at the scheme again, and, you know, whatever changes we decide to make, and it'll be debated by the whole board next week. You know, such is a disappointment of this, that the chairman and I felt that the whole board should have a say in what changes we make. It could lead to much greater inconvenience for people at away games if we have to do additional checks. It could be, you know, difficult for us to trust people to, you know, buy the ticket and award the points. Therefore, adding points to accounts might be delayed if we have to reconcile tickets sold against attendance. And as you can see, you know, just with the last 48 hours, we've been able to speak to Leicester, Watford and Bournemouth and get a huge amount of attendance data correlated to the tickets sold. And we know for a fact, for example, to give you a number, There was actually a very, very small number of people that didn't attend the Barnet game that also didn't attend the Bournemouth game. So, you know, our data analysis can be done that quickly, where if we want to take action against people abusing the scheme, we absolutely can.
So it's not just numbers. It's not just numbers that you have. You've actually got the individual data as to who those ticket purchasers were.
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Absolutely. Okay, so, and we've got that for all of those games. So, I can tell you, right. You know, not by name at this stage, but clearly who didn't attend at Leicester.
So if they turn up at the Amex actually in a future game and they've got a target sort of zeroed in on them, then they'll know who they are.
Listen, I think we've got to put this into context as well. This was one game. It was a unique set of circumstances. People have the right to buy a ticket and not to show up. But what they don't have a right to do is to abuse a loyalty scheme, which is there to provide fairness for all fans. And therefore, in the future, you know, one thing is for sure is that wherever we possibly can, we will reconcile attendance data against tickets sold, and therefore we won't have this abuse again. Whether any action is taken against those that abused the system on Tuesday, that's for the board to decide, and that's not really for me to get into right now. But I can tell you that everyone's disappointed. You know, the chairman who designed the loyalty scheme, the players who noticed the empty seats, the fans that attended, the fans that couldn't attend. Everyone's disappointed, and that can't be right in our first season in the Premier League. That just can't be right.
You're saying that you want the whole board to have a say on this. Would you welcome any fan input, or do you want to keep this at board level only?
Oh, we've had a lot already, and you know, just today I think I've probably had 20 emails with people offering their various different views, and they're different. You know, they're all sort of variations on a theme. I think that the common themes, if you like, are that people felt that what happened was wrong. People felt it was unfair on fellow fans. People were disappointed that the seats weren't taken by people who wanted to support the team on that night, and that something needs to be done. I think they're the common themes. And then there's variations, which is everyone should lose their loyalty points. Those that attended should get more loyalty points. Loyalty points should be scrapped altogether, and we should start again on the system. But, you know, as I said to various people today, and actually on the way home from the game on Tuesday, you know, in 20 years in football, I've worked with four different schemes, and this is by far the best I've worked with.
I was going to say, I mean, we can't be the only club that's had this problem.
No, and I can tell you that Arsenal have had the problem, Bournemouth have had the problem themselves, which is why they were so helpful and cooperative with the data being provided to us. And there are quite a few other clubs out there that have various ways of reconciling attendance with tickets sold. And, you know, it's disappointing because all of these things add cost to the running of the club. And sooner or later, those costs have to trickle down to the people that are ultimately are the people we're servicing, which are our fans. So all the while, we've got pressure on us to keep ticket prices low, keep our operating costs down, put as much money into our football budgets as possible. And yet we've got relatively small numbers of people that constantly test us, try to look for loopholes, look for ways of effectively cheating the system, which puts all of the costs we're taking out back in again, which ultimately will lead to pressure on us on prices. It doesn't make sense to me. It really doesn't. And that's something which only those people that abuse the system will be able to reconcile in their own minds, I guess. Yeah.
Is there a scheme that you're familiar with that you feel is actually is able to perfect or to tweak, you know, the what you have at the moment? Because, like I say, if you want to do away with the abuse, then is there something you've seen out and about that you think actually, you know, that might work instead?
Well, what I don't want to do, Al, is go to a point of not fighting for the best possible price I can get for our fans when we play away from home. That's the first thing I don't want to do. So, you know, if people say to me, well, if you hadn't have had a £10 ticket price, this wouldn't have happened. Well, I'm sorry, but that's nonsense. You know, we've got a responsibility to help fans get to games as cheaply as possible. We've also got a responsibility to try and help the atmosphere as much as possible, because that not only creates enjoyment for the people there, but also helps the players. So we're certainly going to drive at trying to keep the prices as low as we can. I think the ultimate solution is to be able to reconcile actual attendance with tickets sold. And if there's a way in which we can do that where we can also check that the person using the ticket is the person that we sold the ticket to, that would be even better. And there are various systems that we're looking at where that could be done as well. So, you know, from that point of view, that for me is the ultimate. And then loyalty points only get added when we know that the person that we sold the ticket to is the person that use the ticket through the turnstile, and that we know that they're in the ground.
I mean, I think
that's the ultimate.
I think there may be a case, perhaps, for where we have negotiated or home games or had a lower entrance price, then maybe not have loyalty points on those games, perhaps.
Yeah, but I mean, I think the point in this instance is that Bournemouth away 4 days after playing them in the League Cup isn't an attractive proposition. So I think
going to Bournemouth isn't an attractive proposition at the best of
times. My point exactly. So to encourage people to go there, and I think this is the difference now, the fact that we are a club with 22,000 season ticket holders. Sorry, Paul, I'm not answering the point for you, but we've got 22,000 season ticket holders, we've got X thousand on the waiting list. We're a Premier League club, and there are some, a tiny amount. And I think that we're getting to experience it a little bit, and we've seen it with the people who are actually now more interested in the Albion and even the Albion Roar from overseas, that we are now a Premier League club, and I can't help feeling there's one or two people who have got that kind of arrogant swagger of I support a Premier League club, and I'm going to be that Bertie Big thingies, you know. So
it's an important point, as I said just now, and I would emphasise it. We're talking about a relatively small number of people, even with the numbers we saw on Tuesday. There has always been, certainly in my 5 years at the club, a tiny, tiny percentage of people that, you know, wish to test our systems and test our patience at times as well by, you know, buying tickets they're not entitled to buy, you know, buying seniors and juniors when they're adults. A whole range of things, a whole range of loopholes that we've had to close. And all of those things over the years cost us a lot of money in revenue, cost us even more money in management time and cost to resolve them. In one or two cases, you know, we've made very punitive claims against individuals who have systematically abused the system for seasons, not matches, seasons. And one or two people have been landed with four-figure bills that they've had to pay back the club or face court. So, you know, we're not afraid of taking strong action when we need to, but let's put this game context.
Sure.
Okay, Paul. Before we move on from this, we have been contacted by Al's mentioned what I call the Oversea Goals and various other groups from further afield in Scotland and in the north of England, who always been able to go to games. In those sort of areas, obviously not in Scotland, but but they always used to be able to go to games in, say, for instance, Rochdale or Carlisle.
Thankfully, we don't play them anymore, AD.
Yeah, but team, you know, they're finding it difficult now because to get tickets for away games. Is there something that can be done to maybe help those guys?
Well, I think that the problem you've got and the challenge that we have got is that any tickets that you make available via a ballot or on a percentage-based system takes away from the people that over the last 5-6 years have actually earned them. And, you know, we adjusted the loyalty point system to take into account continuous season ticket renewal because, you know, we felt that those people were worthy of being credited with more loyalty points. And of course, you gain more loyalty points by attending what, you know, we can only describe as discretionary matches, as in matches you don't get with your home season ticket, but you can choose to go to, whether they're away games on Tuesday nights in Rotherham or whether they're away games in the Cup, as we saw on Tuesday. So the people that are currently at the top of the loyalty point tiers are those people that have genuinely earned their loyalty points over the 6 seasons that we've been at the Amex. And that's the only way we can measure loyalty, by the way, in terms of the Amex, because we just didn't keep records before that. Those people that have complained the most to me over the last sort of month or two are those people that deserted us from a season ticket point of view after 14-15 season, when obviously we had a very disappointing season. So again, I've not got a huge amount of sympathy, to be honest, for those people, because the ones that are at the top of the pile are the ones that stayed with us. We had a difficult season. That happens to football clubs. It happens to football clubs at the highest possible levels. But the people, the large percentage of season ticket holders, came back after 14-15. They saw what Chris had done in the second half of the season. They stuck with us in 15-16. They had an amazing time. A lot of people that dumped their season ticket at the end of 14-15 came back in on half-season tickets when they saw how well we were doing in 15-16. And many of those, of course, have stayed with us through 16-17 and saw us through to promotion. So those people that did genuinely stick with us or have stuck with us through the whole of those 6 seasons at the Amex and attended lots of away games and went to the discretionary cup games are top of the pile, and therefore they deserve to be getting the tickets to the Premier League away games. Those people that unfortunately can't hold a a home season ticket or haven't held a home season ticket or have interrupted their renewal of their home season ticket or haven't been to many away games or haven't gone to the discretionary cup games are not at the top of the pile. And it's really hard to argue that they've got a case above those that have been with us through all of those times. And likewise, for the people that were previously attending away games, they've been magnificent. But if we set aside a percentage of tickets to help them, then we're taking away tickets from those people that feel and genuinely have earned them. And that doesn't seem fair to any of us at the moment. And certainly it's something that's on the agenda that I want to debate with the board this coming week when we have our board meeting, because it's the flip side of kind of what we saw on Tuesday. There are a lot of very loyal fans out there who, for various different reasons, financial, work or just geographical, can't hold a home season ticket. And at the moment, of course, they can't get access to the away tickets, which is, I can understand, very frustrating for them.
Mm. Okay, well, you are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb, 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and of course on our podcast. I'm Adi Packham. I'm sat here with Alan Wares, and somewhere buying a mustard jumper in the ether is Paul Barber. Or maybe you're after a Black & Decker workbench. Who knows?
For those listening in on radio and on podcast, you'll probably hear that Paul's a little bit crackly. Obviously, we can work out he's not at in the studio with us. He's on a phone about to go to an official function that I think he's very much looking forward to, but we do appreciate taking time out of a Friday evening to don the in my mind's eye, you've got your mustard jumper on. So
is it a black tie event tonight, Paul?
It's a permanent presence, that mustard jumper. I tell you, it's never ever going to be retired. It's special.
Have you got the city's sort of monopoly on mustard jumpers then? Do you believe that you are the mustard king?
Al, as we discussed off air before I came on, that you know mustard is the colour for autumn winter 18, 17, 18. From what I've
told, you made sure that's happened? Have you? You're the man at the centre of the sartorial trade, are you?
Well, I wouldn't say that, but it sounds like I might have called this one my fault.
I can't believe I'm asking this question, but someone did actually put this on our Facebook page earlier. They want to know where you get your mustard.
He answered it last
time,
actually.
I've answered this before. My mum knits them.
Do you remember? Yeah, yeah.
Your mum does cashmere.
So was the mustard jumper the inspiration for the, was it university gold that we're wearing?
Hey, that's selling very well. In fact, I wish I could get a few more of those at the moment.
Okay. Talking of which.
Yeah, all kit is selling well.
I wasn't going to do that now, but I will.
That was beautifully. That was brilliant, Link, Paul. Well done, mate.
I've got merchandise, fake or fortune, written down here.
Go on then.
I know.
Ask your questions.
Okay, Paul. With the increased exposure of the club comes the increase in people trying to trade off the name. What are the club trying to do to alleviate this?
Well, one of the complexities of joining the Premier League is that you also effectively pool your trademarks with Premier League, and therefore you have a responsibility to protect your trademark as part of your Premier League shareholders agreement. So, you know, when we see these sort of relatively small number of small businesses in and around the city or around the county or sometimes bigger businesses across the world looking to associate themselves with us without a license or an agreement to do so, we don't have to just protect ourselves in that respect, we have to protect the Premier League as well. So we have an obligation to act, and we are acting, and we've acted, I think, probably on at least 20 since we got promoted on the 17th of April this year. And on top of that, the Premier League have taken action on some overseas businesses that are trying to trade off our brand as well. So it's a bit like one of those kids' games where the heads keep popping up and you have to keep bashing them down on the pier. Mm. You know, it's a bit like that. You know, we are very aware that there are many organisations out there looking to trade off of us. Why we put the statement out last week is the best way in which we can close these places down is if people don't buy from them. Because if you buy from them, all you do is you're feeding the monster, and the monster gets bigger and more complex, and other people think, well, that's good because they've made money, I can make money as well, and it just makes it even more complex for us. And again, there is cost to all of this. You know, every time we have to write to an organisation to ask them to stop using our trademark or stop trading off our name or stop passing off as a partner of the club when they're not, it actually is an operational cost to us, which again increases the cost of running the club. So there is a real reason that we ask fans not to engage with these people because it's costly.
Andy's got a question to ask here, but I would say that now that Paul's mentioned what he's mentioned, I've just got visions of him walking down the walking up and down the Palace Pier, whacking kids on the head. Sorry, it's just...
Definitely not kids, though.
Yeah, okay,
only fine. If they're wearing fake merch.
Yeah. No! No, violence against children is wrong, AD.
But apparently, Paul... There is the fake shirts out there. We've seen them all on the internet and stuff. And it is, they are the only way you can get a home shirt at the moment, it seems.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the home shirts are an interesting point in question because we've sold home shirts this year, not just in larger quantities than we've ever sold them, but in much more rapid time. And that's really been the issue. I mean, we anticipated, you know, doubling and tripling the sales of home shirts over the year. Of course we did. You know, we're in the Premier League. We're not stupid enough to think there's going to be greater demand. But it's virtually impossible to try and predict demand that is up 400, 500% on anything the club has ever seen before. And in those situations, I'm afraid, you know, those that were, you know, smart enough to get in quick and order quickly, you know, benefited from that. We brought forward a lot of stock that we would normally have not even had to use until Christmas. That sold as well. We then got a top up on that. That sold as well. And now we've got another top up order of several thousand shirts coming in.
So when will that when will that actually arrive?
We're hoping about a month's time. So
this shirt is out of date at the end of the season, though, isn't it?
Sorry.
How long does this shirt run to? Is it a one season shirt or is it two?
No, the home shirt is always a one season shirt. What normally happens, as you know,
it's
is we move our second shirt to become a third shirt, and then that we actually have two new shirts a year, and that's been our policy now.
So
for some
time. So the fact that the current shirt isn't going to be available for another month, and that means that which is going to be out of date in 8 months' time.
Well, yes, there is that, but then again, you know, we have two large buying periods for home shirts, traditionally, at the start of the season, as they're launched, and at Christmas. So it's no real surprise that some people are happy to wait until Christmas and therefore only get 6 months' use out of a home shirt. In this case, there's going to be some people that are buying earlier than normal, i.e. not for Christmas, but earlier than that, and some people, because they didn't move as quickly as others, are going to be buying slightly later. So I don't think there's any particular difference in all of that. And if I look at the numbers, as I said, we've already massively outsold anything we've ever done in the club's history.
Did you say six times what we've done before, or six times the previous season?
500%, roughly.
Yeah, six times,
Yeah, so from that point of view, you know, a lot of those sales are, and when I say 500%, it is that we have sold those shirts much faster than we would normally do. So during the season, normally we would sell through large numbers of shirts, but this will be a record season by a very, very long way. What it ends up, whether it ends up double the sales, triple the sales, or even more, who knows?
It's amazing with how much they are as well, Paul. It must be a major profit maker for you.
Well, it you know, as with all kit deals, you know, we're not Manchester United, we're not Real Madrid, we don't sell anything like the volume that these guys sell. So, you know, the actual price that we buy in at is nothing like the guys, the price that those guys would get. But, you know, it's a good deal for us. We're very happy with Nike. We've got two bespoke shirts this year. The home and away shirts are both bespoke to us. The third shirt, which is the black shirt, which was last year's away shirt, is not a bespoke kit. We've managed to remove the ugly patch off of the front and move it into the actual shirt design, which, you know, I think really looks good. And yeah, of course, the sleeves on the away shirt have created lots of debate. What color are they? I'm still not 100% sure, to be honest with myself. But from that point of view, you know, the shirts have been very, very successful. And even this year with the black shirt, which obviously people have had an opportunity to buy for best part of 15, 16 months now, is still selling in good numbers as well, which is fantastic to see. So, you know, Nike are doing a good job for us, and we're happy with that, and certainly in talks with Nike about continuing that relationship. And the kids love them. And you know, one of the big priorities of moving to a brand like Nike was to help the younger generation get into the club, support the club, wear the club, if you like, across the city. And I think as you walk around Brighton and Hove now, you'll see more and more kids, or over the last few years, you've seen more and more kids wearing our shirt with pride, which is fantastic to see.
I've just got to, along the where AD was mentioning sort of moody shirts that are being sold there, there's a lot of stuff out there on the internet as well about tickets being resold, usually with a package and things like that. I know that obviously you've mentioned before that the club is the only outlet to sell the tickets. So can you just confirm once and for all that, you know, these sites that are offering, you know, a West Stand seat for £600, one that's larceny, and two, these packages don't actually exist anyway. Is that what you said before?
We don't actually authorise any hospitality reseller. We don't authorise any ticket reseller. So anything that is seen on the internet, if it's being sold from a UK-based website, will be entirely illegal. If it's been sold from a foreign-based website, if the law in their country allows them to sell hospitality packages, it almost certainly doesn't exist. And if it does, it will be one of our own fans that has effectively sold it on. And if that's the case, we will very quickly track it, because eventually, and the law in this country means that you have to provide a location for the seat that you're selling, even if you are a dodgy reseller. And therefore, we can actually access that, and we can very quickly track down who has put their ticket up for resale, or if it's a 1901 member, that breaches their terms and conditions, they're not allowed to sell their ticket on a match-by-match basis, and they stand the risk of losing whatever's the balance of their five-year programme. So it's a pretty big risk, and we haven't actually found any 1901 members doing that yet, because it's too big a financial risk for them. So, no, there's a lot of sites out there.
It's probably a scam.
As I say, if you look at it, in most cases, it's a scam. And in fact, there was one poor guy I know at a ground that we were at this season. I won't get into details. Who paid close to £1,500 for his ticket, and it was an entire scam. Mm. So you know, that is a real issue out there for all Premier League clubs, not just for us. But I would caution our fans to stay well away from these guys.
Okay. You are listening to the Albion Roar here on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, online at radioreverb.com, on DAB, and on our podcast. I'm Eddie Packham. I'm here with Alan Wares and Paul Barbers on the end of the telephone. But we aren't doing Shirt of the Week this week for obvious reasons, but we are brought to you in association with oldfootballshirts.com. And I just want to give you Phil's view on what the fake shirts are. And he said, for fake shirts, it's simple. The manufacturers need to stop their downright extortion. Then there wouldn't be a market for the fakes. If you can buy a Nike shirt for £10 in a sports shop, there is no justification for charging an extra £40 for a badge and an advert. There you go.
Paul?
Well, again, it's like anything else. You know, we have got a brand. We've got an intellectual property that has value to it. And a blue and white shirt without an Albion badge just doesn't have the same value, I'm afraid, to people that want to wear it as one without. And that's the reality of so many different brands across the world. You know, there are lots of clothing brands that are able to produce a T-shirt without a logo, much cheaper than one with. But that's what you're buying. You're buying the reputation and the brand and the belonging of the club. I would also, and I've always said this as a parent of three kids that have had replica shirts all their lives, for me, the £40 that I spent on a replica shirt for my kids was probably one of the best £40 I've spent in the entire year. It was never off their backs. It washed well. They used it throughout the year. And at the end of the year, we replaced it, not because it was knackered or completely useless, but because they had grown and we needed to buy them a new shirt anyway.
Please don't tell me. It was a Spurs shirt, wasn't it?
Spurs shirts, weren't they?
Pretty good value.
They were Spurs shirts, weren't they?
I have to admit, they were, but not for my youngest daughter, who is an absolute ardent Brighton fan. So,
really?
You know, from that point of view, she was the one that resisted Tottenham, resisted Vancouver, and
she's a good girl.
Over the last
she's
few
a good
seasons,
girl.
Actually, before 90% of home games and away games.
Before we move on, this has been brought up and by numerous people actually. Under the Araya deal, we were able to do the pink shirts, which were very, very popular to both men, boys and girls of all ages.
I thought you were going to say of all sexes. I know this is Brighton, Aidan. Yeah. Slow down.
But and they would probably be in demand again if they were to be...
Have you had that consideration of doing the pink and white striped shirts?
We haven't, to be honest. I mean, despite sort of, you know, they were popular with some people, but the numbers were very, very, very low. And again, in that sense, you know, when you're working with one of the bigger manufacturers, you do have to commit to minimum order quantities, and therefore it starts to become quite an expensive exercise if you get that wrong, because you end up being left with a lot of stock.
Okay, let's move on for that, because we are running out of time. We do need to talk about let's talk about Hope Powell. What an appointment that was, Paul.
Yeah, how did that happen? That was quite a that came as a bolt from the blue, frankly, didn't it?
It was fantastic. I mean, I worked with Hope for the first time close to 20 years ago when she was the England team coach. Always got on very well with Hope, enjoyed her company and talking football with her. She's probably the most highly qualified female coach in the country, if not in Europe. She's a very, very experienced football person, was a good player in her time, played for her country, scored lots of goals for her country. And we, as you know, were looking for a new head coach. We frankly didn't even have hope on our radar. We didn't think, excuse the pun, there was much hope of getting her into the club. But I got a little whisper that she actually would really like to consider a club opportunity. Made the call to her, had a chat. We spoke for about an hour about what we were trying to achieve with women and girls football and the vision of the club and how we integrate the women and girls program into our main centre at Lancing. And I think she was a little bit captivated by that, intrigued by it. She came down to meet me, met Michelle Warder, who's the chair of our women's football area, met Paul Mullen, who's the head of football administration, who again worked with Hope at the FA with me. And slowly but surely, we sort of reeled her in, as they say, and we're absolutely delighted that she is joining us as a head coach for the women's first team. But such is the influence that Hope has. You know, she'll be able to help develop Amy Merricks, who's taking the team for the opening WSL game this weekend away to Aston Villa. And she'll also have an influence on some of our other coaches who work within our regional training centre, which, of course, is a tier one centre. We had over 200 girls trial with us this summer alone. And Hope's influence, not just as a highly qualified coach and coach educator, but her influence as a real leader in women's football, I think, is going to be just brilliant for us. And we're really thrilled to have her join us.
And it's great for the image of women's football for this club as well. It will be projected worldwide.
Well, we had Amy Merricks and Sophie Perry on the show a couple of weeks ago, and they were absolutely blown away. They really were like a couple of kids in a sweet shop.
Well, I mean, you know, this is such a huge coup for us, to be honest. And you know, we're so thrilled, not just for the team, because they're going to hugely benefit from having Hope working with Amy and developing them in WSL1, but for the whole of our women and girls program, not just ours in our club, but right the way across Sussex. Because I think the type of person Hope is, she's outspoken, she's passionate, she's inspirational, she's highly qualified, she's experienced, she's been there, she's seen it and done it. I think she's going to be an inspiration for a generation of girls to play more football in this part of the country. And I think that is just brilliant. And someone of Hope Powell's quality shouldn't be lost to the game of football. I mean, I was delighted that she was being a coach educator for FIFA and UEFA and working with the PFA. But someone of her standard and someone of her experience should be actually on the grass, not in a classroom, in my opinion. And if she can do both, even better. But certainly someone of Hope's quality should be on the grass, and she soon will be, which is just fantastic.
Okay, well, good luck to the girls. The season starts off, as you said, at Aston Villa this weekend. They are at home next weekend, which unfortunately clashes with it's the same time as the Arsenal game.
By the way, we tried to get that one change, but the FA wouldn't have it, which, again, to me is bonkers. You know, we're trying to grow the women's game. We're trying to build attendances. We're trying to generate interest. We're trying to generate coverage. So to go up, you know, against the men's first team playing away at Arsenal in the Premier League is absolutely silly. And we really should think a little bit more widely and laterally about how we schedule fixtures for men's and women's teams. If we want everybody to take them seriously, and we want everyone to attend, and we want everyone to help us grow the game. So I'm personally disappointed with that, and it's something I will be taking up with the FA directly, because I just think it doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
Sure. I mean, with that nature of sort of arbitrary matches being able to move and not move, and obviously in this instance, you know, Brighton against Arsenal clashing with, I think it's Brighton against Durham City, I think it is, for the women, is another spectre seems to be sort of bumping down the pipeline. It might be some whimsical businessman who just wants to make a name for himself, but the spectre of the 39th game seems to be, you know, on its way down to yes. Could you tell us sort of where we're at with that and what the club's attitude to it is?
Well, I've been to 3 Premier League meetings now, and it's not been discussed once. So
it's a bit of hot air coming from the States, you reckon?
I really don't know where it's coming from, but I can tell you that it hasn't been discussed once. Whether it's going to be on the agenda for our meeting on the 4th of October, I really don't know. Certainly from the agenda I've seen, it isn't. But no, I don't know where that's coming from. I mean, I think at some point there's going to be another test of resolve on that one, whether there is an appetite from clubs to want to play a competitive game in a different country. But, you know, for me, I'm a traditionalist when it comes to football. I love watching domestic football. I love watching two sets of fans come together. I love watching the game in the city that it's supposed to be played in. And it would certainly take a lot to convince me that it was a good thing to do, and certainly not a good thing if it takes away from our tradition, what makes our league and our game as popular as it is, not just here but all over the world. So
yeah,
I understand the marketing value and I understand the potential commercial value, but the integrity of the game for me is paramount, and likewise the respect for supporters is.
I was about to say I've never actually made a statement on here along the lines of that, you know, me and AD speak for Albion fans. We don't. We're just a couple of blokes who do our radio show and we have a good time doing it and we have a natter and blah blah blah. But I think I'm fairly confident that I would speak for 90% of all Brighton fans to say that the notion of the 39th game is a disgusting and morally repugnant one. Yes, there's a few quid in it, but the rest of us, it just leaves us cold. I do not want my Brighton Hove Albion taken away from me for the sake of some fat cat's jolly amusement. Actually, this is our club. It's our community club. We fought for it. It's ours. And no one else is going to have it. Sod off. Sorry, that's how I feel about it. You know, I'm appalled. When before we got to the Premier League, I was appalled at the notion of it, and now that we're actually part of the discussion, should the discussion be on the table again, you know, if the fans ever are going to get a say, no.
I think that would be echoed up and down the country as well.
I'd hope so, yeah.
And I think there's a big difference. I hear it a lot that NFL games are brought here and NBA games are brought here. It's a big difference because, you know, I've worked, as you know, in North America, and the amount of travelling support for a start is virtually non-existent. Mm. So, you know, that isn't the same there.
No.
It's not the same for NFL. It's not the same for NBA. Mm. And I think also, you know, because the franchises in North American leagues move, you know, these franchises are not as rooted in their communities as we are in ours. And therefore, there's a very big difference between, you know, moving games from North America to the UK and other parts of the world than moving British football or English football to other parts of the world. They're very, very different things.
Just before we close, another thing that's being mooted is 7:45 Saturday kickoffs. Where do you stand on that?
Well, again, it's certainly not been mooted at Premier League meetings.
So, oh, right, okay.
So again, it's just media
talk. I don't
know
where these things come from. But,
right.
I mean,
well, we're media.
Thing,
we're
one
talking.
Thing that we all have to accept now, and you know, it's a final point for me, I guess, on media generally. First of all, you know, you've heard me say it before, Sky do a great job for football and have done for many years. I know they create inconvenience at times, but that's not entirely their fault. 3 p.m. kickoffs live on TV are not allowed in this country, and that's the way it is. But lots of speculation in the media. Our game thrives on the amount of attention that we get. But with that, we also have to accept that there's a huge amount of speculation sometimes. Some of it is just nonsense. And you only see it at its peak in the transfer window. If we had commented on every single player we've been linked with in the transfer window, you'd have got fed up with hearing my voice or seeing my name, that's for sure.
No, never.
But actually, you know, that is part of the game and it's part of this amazing business that we're now part of in the Premier League. It is part and parcel. And if you see the media attendance at our game on Sunday, again, you know, live TV, huge numbers of journalists from the national media, huge numbers of journalists from the international media, coverage going out all over the world. It's just fantastic for Brighton and fantastic for our club after all it's been through over so many years.
Yeah.
To be literally now on a world stage is just special, and I think we should all just enjoy every single minute of it, whatever it brings.
Okay, and on that, we'll leave it there. So thank you very much to Paul Barber. I'm AD Packham, that was Alan Edwards. There's so much we didn't get through, Al. We didn't talk about Amazon and Facebook taking over and drinking inside of football pitches, all sorts of stuff.
To talk about that.
But you're just going to have to come back, Paul.
Wait a minute. Where's me jumper? Where's me jumper? Pass me jumper! Pass me jumper! Dancing in the disco, bumper to bumper! Wait a minute! Pass me jumper! Pass me jumper! Pass me jumper! Pass me jumper! Pass me jumper, oh no! Dancing in the disco! Go, go, go. Dancing at the disco. Oh no, oh no, oh no. Dancing at the disco. Go, go, go. Dancing at the disco. Oh no, oh no. It's alright to say things can only get better. You have lost your brand new sweater. I know I had it on when I had dancing in the disco. Go, go, go. Dancing in the disco. Oh no, oh no. Dancing in the disco. Bumper to bumper. Wait a minute. Where's me jumper? 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 It's alright to say things can only get better. You have lost your brand new sweater. Pure new wool and perfect stitches. Not the type of jumper that makes you itches. Oh no. Dancing in the disco. Go, go, go. Dancing in the disco. Oh no, oh no. And my mother would be so, so angry. And my brother would be so, so angry. And my girlfriend would be so, so angry. And my dog would be so, so angry. Cause I was dancing at the disco, bumper to bumper. Wait a minute, where's me jumper? 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 Oh no.